The Tom Woods Show, episode 737.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If you're a homeschooling parent and you're tired of running yourself ragged, then check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And check it out through my special link where you get three free bonuses totaling $160. My special link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. You guys are in for a treat today. Bill Kaufman returns to the show. I just love Bill. I love his writing. I love the way he thinks. I love his originality. And he's just a great, decent guy all around. And we're talking about his book, America First, It's History, Culture, and Politics. This book has been reissued just recently with a brand new preface and epilogue. And it's such a wonderful book. It's just over 20 years old, but it's brought up to date with the new preface and epilogue. But it's really it's just a tremendous book. It covers some important American history, literary history, cultural. It's just a wonderful book to read. You will not be upset at me if you read this book. So you're definitely going to want to check out America First and perhaps more about Bill Kaufman. Bill has been, he's probably been published in, I don't know, more periodicals than I've read over the years. He's been published everywhere. He's written many books. I've never been sorry that I've read a Bill Kaufman book. He wrote the screenplay for the wonderful film Copperhead. So you've heard him talk about that on the show if you're a longtime listener. Just a tremendous guy. I don't know what else to say. He's one of my favorite guests ever on the show. So I'm delighted to be able to welcome him back. Bill, thanks for being here again.
Oh, Tom, it's great to be here. Great September day, you know. It's that hybrid of spring and fall, so I'm invigorated.
Well, I'm down here in Florida, and it ain't no hybrid of nothing. It's still summer. Still terrible. But listen, this book, I'm telling you, this is why I love Bill Kaufman. This is why I belong to the Bill Kaufman Appreciation Society. It's not just a series of chronicles of individuals, but there are chapters on individual people. What I love about it is that if you recall Russell Kirk's book, The Conservative Mind, he, in that book, chronicles a number of people. But I personally, my recollection of the book, and Brad Berzer is going to dislike me for this, but is that each of those people comes out sounding exactly like each other one. They all sound the same. They all believe in order as the mother of liberty. And all right already, Russell.
We order and liberty, Tom. Yeah.
I mean, enough is enough already. Whereas here, each one of these comes across so crisply and differently in these pages. So let me start off with a totally bizarre way of starting. I don't want to talk about America First or Donald Trump or anything.
Alrighty.
I want to talk about Sinclair Lewis. Because I'll tell you, something that surprised me about this book, about Sinclair Lewis, was that I did what all high schoolers did. I read Babbitt. And then actually, when I got out of high school, I read a couple more of his books just for the heck of it. And I drew the conclusion that he was like a Mencken laughing at middle America. And now you're making me rethink that.
Lewis, for the listeners who aren't aware, he was a Minnesota-bred novelist who achieved fame throughout the 20s, his books Main Street and Babbitt and others. They're hilarious. They read very well. I'm glad you brought up the Mencken parallel. Like Mencken, you can read Lewis today and laugh out loud, especially Babbitt. And he was thought to be a scoffer at small-town idiocy and the Rotary Club and all this sort of thing. But in fact, Lewis's real beef with small-town America is that it wasn't itself. It was falling prey to standardization, and people were adopting their ideas from the distant capitals. And that plays out, I think, in a lot of Lewis's books, especially Babbitt, which is a brilliant satire. And the irony is that Lewis loved George Babbitt as his wife, Dorothy Thompson, whom Lewis called the talking woman. So you can probably figure out why she was actually Lewis's ex-wife. But, he loved Babbitt. His complaint is that Americans were too henpecked by the cultural capitals. So Lewis, not surprisingly, in 1940-41, was actually a card-carrying member of the America First Committee, which opposed U.S. involvement in the Second World War. And this is despite the fact that he was, he'd been a longtime crusader for racial justice. In fact, he was outraged when the German government wanted to actually reprint one of his novels in the 30s. He told him his name was actually Sinclair Levinson or something like that. they backed off. But Lewis was a great figure, and he was like a lot, as you say, like a lot of the people in the book, Gore Vidal or Edward Abbey or William Fulbright, Alice Roosevelt Longworth. He was an iconoclast. He was idiosyncratic. He was an American original, which is to say, he was an original American. You couldn't fit him in a box. You know, there'd be no place for him on MSNBC or Fox. You know, he's not red or blue. I mean, and geez, who is?
Yeah, who is indeed? I mean, anybody who is so boring and awful, you can't possibly tolerate them. And it reminds me of one of my favorite lines from your Rally for the Republic speech about, you know, if Ron Paul were to be heard in such and such context, you know, they would probably beat him over the head with rolled up copies of Mitt Romney speeches, or what's even worse, they'd make him listen to Mitt Romney speeches. I just love that. All right, I got this chapter, The Merchants of Death of Sunset Boulevard, and in there, Senator Nye, North Dakota Senator Nye, referring to the movies, says, "They have become the most gigantic engines of propaganda in existence to rouse the war fever in America and plunge this nation to her destruction." Now, that is a stunning quotation from a U.S. senator, but what I'm curious about is, of course, today, you know, the movies have gotten a little more subtle sometimes. It's not quite so obviously over the, you know, hitting you over the head, but it's not that much more subtle. So I'm curious to know, how do you think the movies have changed in this regard, particularly with regard to the military and adventurism and stuff like that? I mean, haven't we seen some critical movies these days?
I guess we have, sure. I mean, something like Black Hawk Down or my own film, Copperhead, but Platoon. But I don't know. My theory is it's almost impossible to make an anti-war film. Because there's something in each of us that stirs to the drumbeat, and you know you can see this back in like before the Civil War, you know, when you had a lot of New Englanders who were, you know, philosophically pacifist, especially a lot of there were a lot of pacifist abolitionists whom I greatly admire, but once the war starts, the bloodlust stirs. You know, and then they want to go trample out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. Well, I mean, today, like in movies, yeah, you can claim it's an anti-war movie, but once you see, you know, men in battle, it's almost impossible not to put yourself in their place, as we do when we sit in the movie theater. So, you know, I always thought, I mean, Dorothy Day, Henry Thoreau, Gandhi, you know, they could go into Full Metal Jacket, and by the end, they'd want to be, you know, napalming a Vietnamese baby. It's just, it's impossible to make an anti-war film. And so, yeah, these movies are usually made, of course, with the cooperation of the U.S. military. And they almost always end up, I mean, it's one thing to respect military men, as I do, and I think that, but it's tough to separate sometimes the people from their mission. And so I think that, you know, it's... I don't know. Militarism, martialism has become a kind of secular religion, and it's dispiriting. The default position of most Americans used to be anti-war. You know, there's a tremendous anti-militarist heritage in this country, as you know, going all the way back to the Revolution. But that was lost, I think, in the second half of the 20th century, with the Cold War especially, and even now, while we have, you know, well, I'll leave it there. But.
Well, you know what? I want to ask you something that I think might be a little tricky for you to answer.
Sure.
I've got a lot of questions that'd be easy for you, but I think
sure.
this
oh,
one's
I like
a little
softballs, Tom. Jeez.
Yeah. Oh, I'm the king of the softball.
Tee it up, baby.
this one's a bit of a screwball because,
okay,
you know, I've because my own thought has evolved on this over the years. I started off as a, you know, in 1990, I was entering college and I supported the Persian Gulf War that year because, well, that's just what you did. I was, you know, I got National Review in the mail and that's what you did. And then as time went on, I modified that. But I'm upset primarily at the war makers, at the because the average person was not sitting around saying, I'm terrified of Saddam Hussein. Like, we all know that.
Right.
Nobody in his right mind was worried about Saddam Hussein. So I don't blame the average American for that. But at some point, you have to I mean, there has to be some moral culpability. I can't. I've gotten to the point where I look at somebody from the military, and frankly, I'm skeptical. I don't say, "Oh, this is an honorable profession that you're in." Not these days, it's not. And at what point does even Bill Kaufman say, "Look, pal, you know, at some point maybe there was some merit in saying I'm defending the country." But at this point, unless you're just not reading anything, there's no justification for doing this.
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying, and I'm largely sympathetic. But you know, I have a couple friends who are in the military, and they're really honorable guys. And so
yeah, see, just, that's what complicates it for me.
I can't take that last step, you know.
Right.
But I know what you're saying, and in fact, now I see Christian parents who are proud of their children joining the armed services, and I know these kids. Often join. I mean, sometimes it's for mercenary reasons, or they want, you know, college aid or something. But a lot of times, it's because they love their country, and their country. They think of the people who live, you know, their neighbors and their family as their country, and that's an honorable motive. But the problem is, especially say if we get to President Hillary Clinton, is that you know these kids are going to be participating in acts of mass slaughter against people whose governments, you know, refuse to kowtow to say you know, U.S. dictates on transgender bathroom policy. And it's, at some point, I think people have to discourage their kids from joining the military. I mean, I would certainly have been at that point long ago, but.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially with the President Clinton. Not that the President Trump would be much better, but.
Yeah, I'm with you. All right. Let's get to the. What is evoked in people's minds when they see the title America First, like what comes out in people's minds. America First, of course, recalls, and this is why Trump got in trouble for using the term, recalls the America First Committee of the Second World War. Now, these are the most, I would say, the most demonized anti-war people, maybe in all of human history. I don't know if they're. I'm being serious. I can't think of anybody. So give us the other side of the story. There are a lot of people who don't know that JFK. You know, it can boast people like JFK, Gerald Ford, the most milquetoast person in the history of the world. So many important people belong to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And taking it back just a little bit further, the funny thing is that, as far as I can tell, the first time America First was used as a political slogan was in 1916. It was one of the slogans of Woodrow Wilson, along with "He kept us out of war." And, of course, after Wilson's reelected in 1916, he plunges us into war. But America First was commonly used in the 1920s by everyone from conservatives like Warren Harding to progressives like Hiram Johnson. It simply meant we should not go abroad in search of dragons to slay. We should tend to our own constitutional republic rather than venturing abroad. And as you say, this brings us up to 1940-41. The America First Committee was born in September 1940 at Yale Law School. Its founders included Kingman Brewster, later president of Yale, Robert D. Stewart Jr., who was the heir to the Quaker Oats family and who later served as U.S. ambassador to Norway, Sergeant Shriver, later head of the Peace Corps, Kennedy in-law, McGovern's running mate in 72, Potter Stewart, who was Supreme Court Justice. You know, it had 800,000 or 850,000 members, depending on the source. So it was by far the largest anti-war group in American history. Under its banner, speakers ranged from Norman Thomas, the head of the Socialist Party, longtime leader of socialists in America, to Alice Roosevelt Longworth, Teddy Roosevelt's daughter. There was an American Legion contingent, Hamilton Fish, a longtime congressman who was one of the founders of the American Legion, Hanford McNider, who was the National Committee Chairman of the American Legion. Its financial base, it was not like all funded by George Soros or Bill Gates. I mean, its financial base was broad. It was mostly Midwestern manufacturers, Sterling Morton of Morton Salt, Jay Hormel of the Hormel Meatpacking, the Quaker Oats people. It was as American as apple pie and Bob Dylan and tax revolts and, you know, Geronimo. I mean, it was deeply dyed in the American dream, and it spoke for the overwhelming number of Americans. Even into the fall of 1941, opinion polls showed that 80% of Americans were opposed to armed intervention in the European war. Now, if you ask, are you in favor of aid short of war, then it's closer to 50-50 or a slight majority opposed to aid short of war. But, you know, it was essentially what happened is that in political disputes, one side sometimes demonizes, vilifies the other side. FDR administration, some of FDR's worst hatchet men, people like Harold Ickes, would call the America Firsters pro-Nazi in the way that people in the Gulf Wars called those of us who were against the war in Iraq pro-Hussein, you know, pro-Saddam. And usually, like after a war, like after the First World War, there's this stepping back and reconsidering and thinking, geez, we kind of lost our heads. And in fact, these people who were against the First World War, like Gene Debs, you know, they were really wrong. They should be released from prison. You know, they were in the American tradition of dissent. I think that happened after Vietnam, although it was messier. After the First World War, that didn't happen. We were right into a Cold War where we had a new enemy, the Soviet Union. And, you know, the slander stuck. And the thing is, while these people were still alive, while people who lived through it were still alive, the slanders weren't as effective. I mean, if you look at the careers, I just mentioned the founders of the committee, they all had fantastic careers that, you know, according to the standards of the American establishment. I mean, people who had worked with them, they knew they were, they knew the American First Committee was fine. It was a middle American anti-war group. But those people have almost all died out now. And so it's, you know, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And so you have these smears by these ahistorical slanderers. It's remarkable. Yeah, you mentioned JFK. JFK was not active in it, but he sent the committee, I think it was a check for $100, saying, you know, what you people are doing is essential and vital.
Yeah.
You know, it's remarkable the mendacity of the anti-America First assault. And yeah, and Trump actually picked it up, actually kind of by mistake. The funny thing is, when Pat Buchanan had written his book, A Republic, Not an Empire, in 1999, he was brought through put through the ringer. It was a kind of non-interventionist reinterpretation of American foreign diplomatic history. And he suggested maybe we should have stayed out of that war, taking the same side as, you know, JFK and Sergeant Shriver and those people. And the usual smears are thrown at him. One of the guys who smeared him was Donald Trump, actually.
Yeah, I remember.
Who was a contender for – he was a contender or a stalking horse in the Reform Party nomination race of 2000. And Trump, I forget the exact – he said something like, oh, he's a Hitler lover or some idiotic.
Yeah, he's a Hitler lover and an anti-Semite, yeah.
Yeah. And so Trump – and then you fast forward, 17 years, I think it was March or so of 2016, Trump's being interviewed by the New York Times, and he's laying out his platform, as it were. And one of the reporters said, well, it sounds like you're America First. And then he says something like, his response was something like, well, look, I'm not an isolationist, but yeah, America First, that sounds good. So, I mean, it was not really a historically conscious adoption of this term on Trump's part.
Right.
But he's shown that it's not toxic. I mean, the last, you know, Buchanan used the phrase, and before Buchanan, actually, Doug Wilder, who was the first black governor of Virginia, a really substantial guy, and he was going to run for president in 1992 Democratic primaries. In 1991, he announced his candidacy, that he was considering a candidacy, and his slogan was "Put America First." You know, let's kind of stay out of wars and repave roads or whatever. And he was very sternly lectured by the New York Times editorialists that you can never use this phrase.
Yeah.
Well, the one good thing Trump has done is that he's detoxified the phrase. I mean, he's used it, and it, you know, people respond to it, you know, because as you say, people, you know, look, the average guy in Butte, Montana, or Anniston, Alabama, or Oklahoma City is not sitting around aching to intervene in Syria, you know? I mean, his reaction, you know, he thinks, you know, what I commonly hear around here, I live in rural America, is, look, I don't care what's going on there. You know, why don't we stay out and tend to our own business? I think that message has tremendous popular appeal, and to the extent that Trump taps into it, which is partial, it's really it really resounds, I think.
Well, also, what's the alternative to America First? America 7th? America 13th? I mean, I think you should turn it around that way and say, well, what number would you like me to assign to America to make you happy? And I'll do it. I mean, that would be a great Trump response, but unfortunately...
It would be.
Yeah, unfortunately, you won't do that. All right. Let's move on to a... actually, you know what? Let's say something about the merits of the case just briefly, because there's a paragraph in your book, and doggone it, I can't find it right now, in which you say, look, maybe the strategy of America First would have been a disaster. Maybe it would have been great. Maybe Stalin and Hitler would have exhausted each other and we would have saved ourselves a whole lot of trouble and tragedy. Mm-hmm. But what we did get was, you know, obviously 50 million deaths and we got half of Europe handed over to Stalin and all this. I mean, is that so obviously the best conceivable outcome? So 50 million deaths was the best we could have done, and if you're complaining about that, there's something wrong with you. You're saying maybe that's not a reasonable position to hold.
Yeah, why? What's wrong with looking at alternatives? Absolutely, yeah, you're right. I forget the exact line, but yeah, you look at what happened. 6 million Jews, you know, murdered. Tens of billions of Russians and Poles and Japanese murdered. Half a million Americans murdered. And you get the hypertrophying, this enormous growth of the American state in the Second World War. You get unprecedented uprooting of the population. Half of Europe handed over to Stalin. Why is it verboten to consider alternatives? It's bizarre.
Now let's fast forward. I want to talk about something that you yourself were involved in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Now, it's funny. You were with the American Enterprise for a while at the American Enterprise Institute, and I don't know how you got away with that, Bill. It must just be everybody loves you.
I had a good buddy of mine. I worked for Senator Moynihan in the 1980s. And a good buddy of mine was named editor-in-chief of the American Enterprise Institute in the mid-90s. And they said, hey, you want to be an associate editor? Sure. I was there for probably a dozen years. And, I mean, I was off-site, of course. I was living up here. And I got to do a lot of great interviews with everyone from Shelby Foote to Joe Paterno. So I sort of enjoyed my time there. But you're right. A lot of people thought it was incongruous. And it was. But I don't really fit. The thing is, I don't really fit anywhere. So I figure, hey, if
But Bill, for you, I mean, you were against the Reagan doctrine in the 1980s. Now that's
yes,
not
I was.
Fitting. That's you don't fit. Yeah.
All right, Maria, that's right. I was accused of being pro-Sandinista. I remember that. Yes.
I mean, it helps that you don't have an abrasive personality and people like you, because otherwise you would have been out on your ear. I personally think. All right. Anyway, let's get to the 1990s, because
sure.
when I first met you, I was in my early 20s. It was the early 90s. It was at the John Randolph Club meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And now you won't remember this, but to me, as the youngest guy in the room, everybody was a celebrity, and I just thought this was the greatest experience of my life. I had so much fun at this thing. And this is the period that some libertarians like Murray Rothbard and Lou Rockwell get criticized for. How dare you reach out to the right? Like, it's never wrong to reach out to the left. That's never wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But reaching out to the right, that is forbidden to certain kinds of libertarians. You know,
and the right were I think pretty much the guys at Chronicles and the Rockford Institute, which were quirky and conservatives.
Yeah, and they were great people. I mean, okay, I've had my issues with Tom Fleming. Who hasn't by this point? But they were people I learned so much from. They
sure.
saved me from neoconservatism. Those people, reading that magazine. I read that magazine because Rothbard made a fleeting reference to it in one speech. So I thought, oh, if he's reading it, maybe I should read it. And then I was immediately captivated by that.
Oh, yeah. For a period of about, I don't know, 5-6 years, I think it was the most exciting magazine out there.
So can you just share some recollections about those post-Cold War years and what was going on ideologically?
That was an interesting period because if you'll recall, William F. Buckley said, I think I wrote in the mid-late 50s, that conservatives have to accept the existence of this enormous, militarized, semi-totalitarian state because of the existence of the Soviet Union, which he said was a world historical evil empire. Now, if somehow, by some miracle, the Soviet Union should disappear or be pulverized into smithereens, as some National Review editors desired, we could return to being what Gene Kirkpatrick, Reagan's UN ambassador later, called a normal country. Well, all of a sudden, the Soviet Union peacefully dissolves. You know, remarkable. It opened up, all of a sudden, new paths were opened up. You know, roads not taken, all of a sudden, the roadblocks were removed. There were all kinds of new possibilities. It was really a heady time. I compared it in some ways to the 30s, during the early years of the Depression, which, awful as they were, nevertheless, all kinds of new and interesting philosophical and ideological avenues opened up, and it was very fruitful. And I think the same thing was true in the early 1990s. I mean, the tragedy on the American right is that almost the only guy who really did sit down and rethink everything was Pat Buchanan. You know, I never used to be a fan of Pat. I mean, I always thought he was a great, he's a great stylist. He was very punchy, but I thought, he's, you know, sort of this authoritarian Catholic who likes Joe McCarthy and General Franco, and I'm Catholic, by the way, so I guess I can say that. Although I guess we can always rip on Pat.
We can always, right? Yeah, it doesn't matter who you are.
They're not a protected class.
That's right.
But anyway, so but Buchanan was the one guy who, with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, all of a sudden, this extreme cold warrior, this fixture in the Reagan administration who had wanted, you know, who was been against detente, who wanted to, you know, overthrow the Sandinistas and all this kind of thing, he sits back, he thinks, he ponders, he reconsiders, and he becomes, you know, for the next 25 years, really one of the most impressive spokesmen for peace in the country. You know, by the early 90s, he's saying, look, we should withdraw all our troops from Europe. We should, you know, maybe withdraw from NATO. We should not go to war against Iraq in 91. We should downsize the military substantially and cut the military budget. But unfortunately, very few people on the establishment right had the integrity, honesty of Buchanan. And I think that's one, but you mentioned the Randolph Society. I mean, there was discussion like that there. It was, Murray Rothbard, one of the great leading lights of libertarianism, was involved, Tom Fleming and the guys from Chronicles. And, you know, it was fruitful and exciting. And, it didn't last, but, for that period of the 1990s, I think was a really interesting time in our political history, and it's not coincidental that in this book, which is being reprinted now after 21 years, the last third or so of the book, maybe the last fourth, is about what I think is the most interesting political race, presidential race of our time up until possibly 2016, and that was 1992, where you had three unorthodox figures who, in different ways, embodied aspects of the America First tradition. Ross Perot, Pat Buchanan, and Jerry Brown. We haven't had an election like that since. Unfortunately, we ended up in the general with George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton.
Right. Well, you know, when you say that the we might call the paleo thing didn't last in terms of an alliance between the libertarians and the old right sort of people, at the same time, I think to myself, I personally gained a lot from it. My own horizons were broadened because I got to know you. I got to know Paul Gottfried, whom I'm still glad to talk to. Clyde Wilson, his very last PhD student is a guy named Brian McClanahan, who's very prolific, who's doing great work, has his own podcast. I have him on here a lot. So I got to meet a lot of people I wouldn't have known otherwise. So if you know, in terms of my own selfish point of view, it was a big smashing success. But
it was a tremendously seminal event and period for a lot of people, and I think that the ripples and ramifications are, you know, salutary ripples and ramifications. Good things are, you know, going to extend for a long time.
All right. Now, listen, I got to let you go in a minute. I don't want to keep you too long, even though, of course, I do want to keep you too long. But I said that we can't not discuss Trump because he is the elephant in the room, but I refuse to take your wonderful book and just turn it into a conversation about Trump, you know, because your book deserves more. But you can't not comment. I mean, we did talk about his kind of accidental use of the term, but mm-hmm. where do you think he falls in this world of Sinclair Lewis and E.E. Cummings and John T. Flynn?
Yeah, culturally, he's not there at all. Politically, actually, I draw a parallel in the book between him and William Randolph Hearst, the press baron, media baron, from the early 20th century all the way up till the mid 20th century, who was later subject to the great cinematic slander job Citizen Kane by Orson Welles. But Hearst was an interesting figure. I mean, he's often regarded as this jingo idiot. Who in 1898 helped gin up the Spanish-American War, but in the First and Second World Wars, he and his papers actually opposed these wars. Certainly not on pacifist grounds. He was not a pacifist. He believed in the kind of heavily armed neutrality, and I think there's a Trump parallel there. In fact, let me read from the epilogue. I should mention that I wrote a new preface and epilogue for this book, which was published in 95. This is a line from Hearst. "We want big Americans in a big America, guarded by a big navy, fearing nobody, bullying nobody, insulted by nobody, and sitting in peace and honor, ringed with our 100 ships of battle, ready and able to face the world in a just struggle." To me, that sounds very Trumpian. All this bigness nonsense, and since I'm an advocate of the little America, I would be on exactly the opposite side. But, he wants this huge army, well-armed, you know, the most beautifully funded army in the world, as Trump has said, and yet he's not going to use it, except, I assume, extreme provocation. So, I mean, there is a strain in the America First Committee. There was, as I mentioned, Hanford McNider, head of the American Legion. I mean, there were military people who wanted a big military buildup at the time, but non-intervention in foreign wars, just to guard our coastlines. And now Trump obviously goes well beyond our coastlines, and there are great inconsistencies. But he fits at the margins, maybe. He's not really part of the America First tradition, but he's an interesting figure, and we do have to give him his due. I mean, destroying the Bush family, I mean, what greater prize could he have given us?
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I'm all alone pointing out this merit of his.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I must have disliked the Bush family a lot more than some of my listeners. I don't know what else to say here, but to me, that is a glorious thing.
Right, and interestingly, like Ron Paul back in 2008, Trump in 2016 went before an audience of South Carolina Republicans,
right,
and denounced the Iraq War. You know, Trump said that Bush lied us into it. You know, I mean, there are good things about Trump. He's a really perplexing figure, and I always vote third party, so I'm not going to vote for him anyway. But he's an interesting figure. He does have the merit of being hated by many of the worst people in American life. Although it's always a mistake to think the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know. I think this is a mistake that led some of the vestigial people in the old right to embrace Joe McCarthy when they shouldn't have. And McCarthy, after all, was elected to the Senate in a Republican primary, defeating Bob La Follette Jr., who actually was an isolationist America Firster. McCarthy ran as the internationalist, which everyone forgets. And then in the Vietnam War, I think that conservatives, you know, this was a war plotted, strategized for by the best and brightest of great society liberalism. And yet they saw that, hey, this is going bad. And the conservatives, who really didn't have any part in beginning the war, they're so turned off by the new left and all these hippies won't cut their hair and blah, 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 that they end up holding the bag and adopting it because the enemy of the enemy was their friend. So that's always a bad strategy, I think. But I admit that it's tempting, you know, when you see this unprecedented media assault on Trump.
Yeah, it is absolutely incredible. It really is. Now, I see, my view is that a lot of people who like Trump, who are, let's say, friends of ours who like Trump, mm-hmm. I think they're seeing in him what they wish were there. I think they're seeing in him somebody with the intellect of a Pat Buchanan, mm-hmm. with the knowledge of history of a Pat Buchanan, with the knowledge, with a sense of the significance of this moment. Whereas Trump is basically saying, hey, I'm going to come in here and we're going to clean house and we're going to get things together. And to help me do that, I've got Rudy Giuliani, Chris Christie, Newt Gingrich, and Ben Carson. Well, obviously, he thinks the country's doing pretty well if that's all we need to do. So that's, I mean, come on now, people. Wake. He is not the guy you think he is. I mean, I used to think he might be that guy. And then when I see who he surrounds himself with, it just gets more depressing all the time.
Yeah, yeah, but he is. But again, to draw the parallel with the 92 election, I mean, there is a sense in which he's kind of an amalgam of Buchanan and Perot, but he lacks Buchanan's intellectual acuity and humaneness, and he lacks Perot's Boy Scout patriotism. You know, I mean, he's an interesting figure. What's really interesting is Trump an anomaly or is he a harbinger? You know, Perot, it turns out, was pretty much an anomaly. Trump, we'll see.
Yeah, and I think that was partly because Perot was, I mean, I wouldn't say Trump is ideological, but he hammers home on his ideas. Mm-hmm. Whereas Perot, the thing you walked away with was he bought a 30-minute infomercial where he showed us some charts. And he's got a combination of tax increases and budget cuts and what, forget it. Trump is just making clear it's immigration, it's trade, and it's foreign policy. I mean, it's you can't possibly miss his message. He hammers you over the head with it in these simple, easy-to-remember sound bites that Perot had a couple of sound bites. But other than that, he came across as wonkish and kind of an oddball, whereas mm-hmm. Trump has this alpha male persona, and I think it makes his message resonate more effectively. So I don't think he's an anomaly. I think this is going to be a presence in American politics probably for a long time to come, in the same way I think a Bernie Sanders is likely to be a kind of a presence for a long time to come.
Yeah, well, I mean, the good thing if Trumpism and Sanderism do have legs is that it's going to stretch and extend, I think, the very narrow boundaries of acceptable opinion that we've had for the last couple of decades.
Well, you're
it opens up possibility. But then, you know, Tom, you know, I'm just a cockeyed optimist, Tom.
But you know, I think we have some decent reason for it these days. But anyway, listen, I'm telling you guys, there's probably five people in the world whose writing nonfiction writers whom I just devour and whose writing skills I truly envy. And Bill Kaufman is in that small group. If you have not read a Bill Kaufman book, America First is a great place to start doing it because you're going to love it. You're going to write to me and thank me. And I'm linking to this book on the show notes page. This is episode 737. So tomwoods.com/737 will have a nice link where you can go and grab this book. Of course, you can go order it as Bill would prefer. Go to your local bookseller and order it. But if you can't do that because you've got to have the book now, then he'll look the other way and hold his nose while you order it from Amazon. So I don't want to speak for you, Bill, but that's my instinct.
Well, I appreciate your kind words, Tom.
Well, thanks again for being here. And you know, I hope you start re-releasing a lot more of your books just so I can get you back on the show more often.
Well, I would love to. Always enjoy chatting with you, man.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Yeah, bye-bye, Tom.
All right. Well, lately I have been promoting to you, good listeners, a whole bunch of websites and blogs created by Tom Woods Show listeners. And I got one more for you. And it's ZeroThPosition.com. ZeroThPosition.com. It's a libertarian site, and it's very punchily written, and I recommend it to you because it's edgy, and it's controversial, and it's not just writing about comparative advantage and David Ricardo. It is hard-hitting stuff. There's an essay on there about why the Black Lives Matter movement is not something libertarians should support. The enemy of my enemy is not always my friend. Echoing a theme from today. So worth checking out. Now, I will say, on the other hand, there's a piece in there that deals with religion that I can't endorse, and that says that religion came about because people couldn't find answers to certain questions using reason, so they had to punt a little bit and come up with religion. But that's certainly not the way Christianity developed. It wasn't that people were sitting around
scratching their heads because they couldn't understand where thunder was coming from. And then they just said, well, let's pretend this guy Jesus walked the earth and we'll attribute thunder to him. That's not how that came about. So that, you know, nuts to that. But it's still an interesting site worth checking out. I'm telling you, you will have your ideas challenged over there. Maybe you'll get angry, but perhaps that's what the site owner wants you to do. Either way, zerothposition.com will be listed at tomwoods.com/737 as the listener website mentioned. If you want to get a mention like this, plus several other really juicy and helpful goodies, make sure and check out tomwoods.com/publicity before you get the hosting for your site, and you'll get all these good things. All right, remember, Friday of this week, episode 739, watch for it, baby. It's our debate on Israel, reconciling the creation of Israel with the non-aggression principle and libertarian homesteading. Can that be done? That's what our debaters will be debating on episode 739. So you are not going to want to miss that. Remember also, if you are hearing this in time, this week, September 15th and 16th, 2016, is the end of summer flash sale over at Bluehost, so you can get your hosting for $2.95 per month. You can lock that in for as many as 3 years, so you'd be crazy not to do that. So hold off on starting your site and getting your hosting until Thursday or Friday of this week. So get all the details on all the goodies you can get from me, plus a link to this pretty good deal on hosting at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, that'll do it. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.